And now, fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
In my blue Canadian Rockies, spring is sighing through the trees, and the golden poppies are blooming around the banks of Lake Louise.
Wilf Carter getting us underway today on Route 51 as we look at America's ongoing trade dispute with Canada and its potential impact on Wisconsin's timber and dairy industries. I'm Glenn Moberg. The two countries have been arguing about trade since the time of George Washington, when Canada was still a British colony. A fight over timber products during the Reagan years eventually led to the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which was signed into law by President George H.W. Bush. And in just the past couple of weeks, Wisconsin dairy farmers were hit hard when Canada cut its importation of milk products. In retaliation, a 20% tariff was slapped on Canadian softwood lumber, and President Trump said he wanted to renegotiate NAFTA. We're going to talk about that and other challenges facing the timber and dairy industries with our guests. On the phone, Matt Jensen, Vice President of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and the owner of Whitetail Logging of Crandon. Jensen is a third-generation logger and a certified master logger. And here in our studio today, we have Don Ratke, the Vice President of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation and the Farm Operations Manager for North Central Technical College's Agriculture Center of Excellence. Now, as always, we'd like to hear from you. You can give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I'll read it live on the air. One additional reminder, please help support Route 51 and Wisconsin Public Radio during this, our Spring Pledge Drive. So, Matt, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Don, thank you for being with us. So let's introduce the two of you before we get going. Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself and Whitetail Logging in Crandon.
Like you had said previous in the introduction, I'm a third-generation logger. I've been born and raised in Forest County, Wisconsin. I live near Crandon. I've been in business for myself for 31 years now. I am a strong advocate for professional ethical timber harvesting, and so I'm involved in a lot of local and national associations on behalf of the forest products industry.
Now, you're a certified master logger. What is that?
Certified master logger is a self-imposed, if you will, verification. There are less than 100 master loggers. I believe there's only 50 in the state. I was one of the first to become a master logger. And what that does is it's a self-imposed auditing program by our peers. It's a marketing tool, basically, to show folks that you're doing things properly, all the way from having proper insurance to the on-the-ground work in the woods. And there's actually an inconsistent practices hotline that folks can call if there is an issue with timber harvesting. So we're trying to set the bar high enough. It's a voluntary thing that several of my colleagues in our industry that believe that professional ethical timber harvesting should be a priority. So it's been a successful program since, I believe, it was 2004. 2007.
Okay, and you're also the third generation in your family that's been doing this. This is a dangerous business. What keeps your family in it despite the very hard work and all kinds of inclement weather and the very real safety risks that you face every day?
Well, as one of my grandfathers was into farming and logged in the wintertime, and my father, fortunately, I'm blessed to be able to still work with my dad. They've seen a lot of changes. I started out with a chainsaw as a true lumberjack. My father has seen skidding with horses way back from that to all the way to the high-tech mechanized equipment that we have today. So I'm not in as much danger as my father and grandfather were, but the technology has really advanced so much that we can work in various conditions. And quite frankly, it's just like farming. It's you live in the woods. It's literally in your blood. I've heard comments from folks in the industry that they said you do it for nothing. You love it so much. And that's kind of the way I am. I absolutely love what I do working in the forest. It's the best office in the world.
Don, you're nodding in agreement here.
Yeah, it's a way of life. It's a business also, but it is a way of life. But you do have to run it as a business if you're going to make a living at it.
Well, let's talk about your professional organizations. Don, you're the vice president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Who are your members? What do you do, and what's your mission?
Our members are ag-related, foresters and that. We have associate members and voting members. Voting members are anybody that's connected with production agriculture. We're known as a grassroots organization, so anything we have as policy is developed by a county. From the county, if it's passed there, it goes on to the state. If it's a national or federal regulation or rule or something that we want to weigh in on, then it would go out to the American Farm Bureau Federation. And it all starts at a county. Nothing comes from the top down. The ideas have to come from our members on what we want to do.
What got you involved in this? What's your background in agriculture?
My background in agriculture is I've dairied basically my whole life. My wife and I took over our family farm in 1985. We went into a partnership in 1998. We were in that till 2009. We got out of that. I worked for a 600-cow dairy, and I was hired on at the Technical College in 2010.
Well, tell us about that. It's a relatively new program. It's been around for a few years, the Ag Center of Excellence. What is it, and what do you try to do?
The Ag Center of Excellence was an idea that was formed by a group of people. It was a partnership for Progressive Agriculture, the PPA. A spinoff group of that was the Dairyland State Academy, and they went to President Wires of the college and ask if she would be interested in partnering to do some type of ag education, because the Technical College had basically had gotten away from all the ag programs that they had from the previous president. So we had a collaboration between government and school and industry. So Marathon County government gave the Dairyland State Academy $1 million to start the Dairyland State Academy. They bought property in the town of Maine, which is now the village of Maine. They built the buildings that are there, the barn, the classrooms, and the heifer barn or whatever. So the way everything sits there now, it's all paid for. We had contributions from individual people and organizations to buy the cattle. So as everything sits, everything is paid for. We try to keep that as revenue neutral, the way I've always put it, as what we can. We are a school, but we try to run it as a working farm and show the students how that works.
So you've got actual cattle and cows this Ag Center of Excellence, and it's a very real learning experience for the kids.
The unique thing that we have there is we have a robotic milker. So we have room in our barn for 60 head. The robot milker will milk 60 cows. With the dry cows, we're running 60. We try to have a lot of hands-on experience for our students, because a lot of our students don't have an ag background. My biggest hope is that as these young people come to the farm, they don't know everything what there is involved with agriculture, production agriculture, that we can show them it's not just milk and cows, but they can be a herdsperson, they can be a calf raiser. We teach them how to vaccinate calves and all the things what they need to know. And I'm hoping that they see they like this or they don't like that, and that kind of points them in the direction of where they would like to go in life.
And Matt Jensen, you're the vice president of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. That's an organization that's based in Rhinelander. You work out of Crandon. In fact, I think you're talking to me right now somewhere in the woods in Forest County. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm sitting in a harvester right now as we speak.
All right. Tell us about the Great Lakes Timber Professionals. Who are your members? What do you do? And what's your mission?
Okay, the Great Lakes Timber Professionals is a two-state organization between Michigan and Wisconsin. There are more members in Wisconsin at this point. But our members, or our board consists of, and our membership consists of a majority of loggers and truckers, small businessmen like myself. We have, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 member companies right now, and that's a range from every from transportation folks that are on our board. There's large sawmills, large paper mill industry type folks, but the majority of it is loggers and truckers, and that's how our bylaws are set up for that, to have that majority. But we have folks on our board that are from, we have somebody on the board from UW-Madison from the education sector. We have somebody from on our board from transportation, which happens to be somebody from railroad right now. So we try and have a wide range of folks so that we can reach a lot of people. And one of our main goals is definitely to be the progressive voice for the forest products industry. That's our kind of our motto. And we have do a lot of things through education, which is very important today. There's a lot of misconceptions about logging and forestry and forest products. And there's a lot of political things, just like in the agricultural business. There we have connections with folks from Madison all the way to Washington, D.C. We meet with representatives nationally. We were just in Washington, D.C. The end of March. Our national organization that we're affiliated with is called the American Loggers Council, which represents 31 states of logging professionals across the country. So there's a lot of political things, policy, proper forest management, and transportation issues is a huge thing. So those are all sorts of things that we try and work on and educate folks on.
Well, Matt, we're here to talk about politics, so let's talk about this 20% tariff that's been slapped on imported Canadian softwood products. What do you think of that? And I understand that that's a little bit of a simplification on my part. The tariff actually ranges from 3% to 24%, but I guess it evens out to about 20% on the products.
Yes. Well, the tariff, the prior tariff that was on before this one expired was somewhere in the range of 30%, and there were actually quotas for Canada. And I'm not quite as well versed on Mexico, but Canada, and there were quotas. And this new so-called agreement that they're going to be negotiating on, the 20% range is actually less than before. So what that's doing is, it's hopefully leveling the playing field. I don't think it's something that any country wants to do, especially with a good neighbor like Canada is with us, but it's a necessity. Canada has increased their timber production about 15%, and all of those products are coming across into the United States kind of at will.
The figures I've got, we import $5.7 billion in softwood products from Canada every year, and the duties that have been slapped on them amount to about $1 billion on those products. So let's see how that affects you. Softwood, we're talking fir, spruce, pine trees, coniferous, is that right?
Well, it is, but it's basically any forest products. So what that's doing is anything, the raw material, if you will, and lumber is coming across into the United States, and with the dollar value, the currency, the difference is give or take about 30% right now, so that's not even covering that to level that currency. So it affects us greatly because it floods, we're in a supply and demand market, just like farming, and it floods the market for raw material, so that diminishes the demand for our raw material, and after that, then the price that we get for delivering to various sawmills and paper mills and that thing.
Well, does this mean that you're going to have more business? Is this going to be a boon for Wisconsin timber producers if we don't have as much Canadian lumber coming in? Does that mean you're going to be producing what they aren't importing?
Well, what it should do, and I think what the goal is to get it back to where it was before to create that even keel. It will increase our business based on the last couple of years. The last couple of years have been extremely tough because in the last year, we've had an extremely wet year, and we're starting out to be very a lot of rainfall, and we're very weather dependent in our industry. We don't have any, there isn't any kind of a fallback subsidy, insurance of any sort. If we don't get product to the various mills, paper mills, sawmills, we don't get paid. So with this leveling the playing field with this tariff, industry's hoping that it's back to where it was before. They're hoping more in the range of the 30%.
Well, if the Canadian timber is being priced at 20% more, doesn't that mean your timber is going to be worth 20% more as well? Is that going to work out that way?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know. I guess what I'm more concerned about is creating the demand for our raw material, and the price will set itself based on the markets and of the finished product, if you will, whether it's paper or lumber. That will dictate itself by the demand for it on the finished end of things.
And is this going to mean an increase in the price of lumber used in homes? The American Builders Association is concerned about it raising the cost of new homes.
Well, I did a little bit of research on that, talking to some folks in industry, and they're in an average home today, 2x4s, 2x6s. I mean, it may increase the price of a home $1,000. There's not that many board feet of just lumber in a house that isn't the main cost of that. So I kind of disagree with that we'll have to wait and see. I don't think it's going to change it a whole lot myself.
The Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross agrees with you. He says the price may go up a little bit, but nothing like 20%. Don Ratke.
No, I don't see that at all.
Yeah, Don Ratke, we heard a couple of weeks ago that Canadian restrictions on the importation of a raw milk product were going to bankrupt dozens of farms in Wisconsin, driving them out of business. And now we're told that most of those farmers have dodged the bullet and it's not going to be that bad. Is that true?
Yeah, they may have dodged the bullet now, but the question always gets to be is, what's the future? What's in the future? It was stressful, I'm sure, for those farmers that got that letter saying they weren't going to pick their milk up anymore. As far as I know, there was the majority of them have been picked up. A couple of them did sell out. They decided if they were old enough to retire or whatever, they took that option or whatever. But, yeah, those were some stressful times for some of them farms.
And that's a big regional company, Grassland Dairy Products, that told about 60 dairy farmers that it no longer needed their milk.
Right.
And I read that one local cheese company, Mullins Cheese in Mosinee, stepped into the gap, threw them, at least some of them, a lifeline. Bill Mullins, who's the owner of the company, was quoted as saying that he did it in part to help some good farmers stay in business.
Yeah, and Mullins has always been very supportive of people in this region or whatever. They understand where their product comes from. They need the farmers or whatever. And in the same token, they're business people too, and they need to be able to sell their end product. And if they start stockpiling that, the milk still keeps coming in every day. So they've got that balancing act to do too. I did know that they did pick up, I believe it was 8 of the farmers, that they did go out and pick their milk up from them.
Now, this involves Canadian imports of ultra-filtered milk, which is used in cheese production.
It's not Canadian imports. What we were doing was we were importing it into Canada.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. What exactly is ultra-filtered milk, and why did that become such a crucial thing?
Ultra-filtered milk is milk basically what they're doing is they're taking the water out of it, and it's concentrate. The fat, protein, and other solids or whatever are still in it. They just basically are pulling as much water out as what they can, so they're not trucking water around, basically, is what they're doing. And what really happened in the Canadian market is it started in Quebec. Quebec would see it because New York State was part of this also, because New York State had some factories that were shipping ultra-filtered milk into Canada. They actually added 2 classes of milk up in Canada, so there was 4 or 5, and they added 2 more on. Ultra-filtered milk was one of them, and what they did was they lowered the price low enough that it's not inducive for us to import it into there no more. So it wasn't really that they put a tariff on, but they figured a different way around. Yeah, we could still send it there, But at the reduced price, it's not profitable for the plants to do it. So that's kind of where that stood at.
Well, my understanding is that Canada has always been very restrictive in its dairy imports. The Atlantic magazine describes the market as being quarantined, with Canada neither importing nor exporting its products. And they said this one category, unfiltered milk, was for some reason not included in the original restrictions. And when that loophole got closed, well, it affected the farmers here in Wisconsin.
Right. That kind of goes back to this product is a newer product that's out there. So when those agreements were written, nobody ever knew what that was. So as this product came about and they figured out how to do this, that's where the loophole was. And again, that's why they added the two classes of milk to kind of close that loophole or whatever. On the Canadian side, the Canadian farmers are under what they call a quota system. So if you're milking 100 cows and they know how much milk you produce, if you want to put more cows on, you have to buy more quota so you can ship. Whereas here in the United States or Wisconsin, if you're milking 100 cows and you want to add 50 cows on, years ago you would just start milking the 50 cows and the bulk truck would stop and pick it up and they would use it. And now it's to the point where if you want to expand, you're going to have to go talk to your dairy plant and say, okay, this is what I'm looking at doing. Are you willing to pick up this milk? And some of them are saying, no, we're at where we want to be, and we're not looking for more. So that's a big change for us. A year ago, nobody would ever thought of something like this. If you wanted to switch bulk plants, you would say you could talk to a neighbor, and five different plants would be on your yard the next day saying, we'd be willing to take your milk. And now it's if you want to switch, you're on a waiting list to switch to different plants.
And Matt Jensen, we've got two different industries here, both impacted by this trade war, if that's what you want to call it. That's probably a bit extreme. What similarities and differences do you see with the timber and dairy industries?
Well, some of the similarities that I do see is you know, we're being that it's a supply and demand business. We deal with the end users, whether it's mainly paper mills, where you have different quotas and you need to negotiate with them based on price and demand of whether they will be able to, if you wanted to expand your business, you'd need to talk to them and find out and negotiate whether you can increase your volume of production. The probably one of the differences I would see, and I don't know this of the agriculture, maybe our other guests could answer this after I talk about it. Our contracts that we have with various paper mills mainly, they can be, in a phone call, can be stopped. So it's a very volatile industry. We don't have any kind of a price guarantee. You can have a contract for a year and have it in writing, price, volume, and in a phone call, somehow, some way, that can be at, you know, null and void in a phone call. So okay. We really are at a large risk, always have been, and I don't know how to solve that problem in our industry, but it's always been like that.
Today on Route 51, we're discussing Wisconsin's timber and dairy industries and the trade dispute with Canada with Matt Jensen of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association, Don Ratke of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I'll read it live on the air. We're going to take a short pledge break. Here's Gordon Lightfoot with his Canadian Rail Trilogy.
There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run, when the wild majestic mountains stood alone against the sun. Long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real.
Support for WPR comes from the UW Health Breast Center, offering second opinions for more than 4,000 Wisconsin women and men diagnosed with breast cancer each year. More at uwhealth.org/second opinion. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
I think I'll go out to Alberta. Weather's good there in the fall. Got some friends that I can go to work in fall. Still, I wish you'd change your mind. If I'd ask you one more time. But we've been through that 100 times or more. Four strong winds.
Ian and Sylvia with a song about those cold winds in Canada as we talk about the ongoing trade dispute with that country and its impact on Wisconsin's timber and dairy industries with Matt Jensen of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and Don Ratke of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. I'm Glenn Moberg. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742 and please help support Route 51 and Wisconsin Public Radio during our spring pledge drive. And we do have a caller on the line. Let's get right to that. Mike and Edgar, you're on Route 51 with our two guests.
Morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, I keep hearing this about grassland and they're blaming it on Canada and all this, and I'm right in the area. Edgar, I'm only about 30 miles away from Greenwood, and I know farmers that ship over there, and I know people that actually work there. And what I think has got to be a big part of the equation, you know, is around here it's well known that grassland's been buying up all the big farm, you know, as many big farms as they can get their hands on. And it's said that they own 20,000 of their own cows here now, you know. I think this blaming it on Canada is just a kind of a crock because, and what I have heard is that Canada said they were beefing up their ultra filtered milk, you know, that they could, you know, process it. And they've told them a year ago about that, and all of a sudden they're acting like it's a big surprise that they decide that they don't want extra
all right,
here.
All right, Mike, we got it. Thanks so much for the call. Let's have Don Ratke respond to you. Don?
While you're talking about grassland buying up some farms, I've heard a bunch of that. You know, I don't know. You know, it's kind of everybody's call if it's the right thing for them to do or not. They are looking at it as a business decision, and they feel that that's the direction they should go. What ends up getting with a lot of this is it pits the small farmers against the big farmers, and I get where that's coming from. I understand that. But what I see is the rules and regulations that are in place, and be it dairy, be it any other business, whatever that's out there is, the more rules and regulations they put on, it impacts the smaller farmers or the smaller businesses more so than the big ones. The big ones, they can add stuff on or whatever faster and change faster, whereas if you're milking 60 cows and that's what your barn fits, you're not going to add cows on. Or if you're a hardware store and different rules and regulations and that come in, it's hard to keep up with in the finances. And I think that's what grassland is looking at is they're diversifying as much as what they can, right, wrong, or otherwise.
Some have said, Don Ratke, and Mike, thanks so much for the phone call. Some have said that Canada is a scapegoat here. Pete Harden, who's the publisher of The Milkweed, which is a marketing report based in Brooklyn, Wisconsin, says the fault lies with the dairy industry itself in our region. He says the U.S., specifically the Great Lakes region and New York, we've got cheap prices that are tied to huge expansions of mega farms, giant CAFOs with thousands of dairy cows flooding Wisconsin with cheap out-of-state milk. Is there anything to that?
There's out-of-state milk that comes in. We've always had it here in Wisconsin because we've always had the manufacturing plants. So that's what he's saying. Probably there's some truth to that. The big thing is I think if you look at the numbers, the number of cows we've got in the nation are going down. It's just farmers are doing a better job with production, so they're getting more production out of the cows that they have. The end product, be it milk, cheese, butter, ice cream, or whatever, consumption has been down all across the board. And that's where we struggle as an industry to find – to get the consumers to consume more.
Canada is very protective of its homegrown industries, both timber and dairy. And, you know, there are no pure capitalist economies in the world. They're all kind of a mix of capitalism and socialism, even in the U.S. But isn't it fair to say that Canada is more socialist than us, and it's the government may have its hand in these industries a little bit more than they do in the U.S.?
They do. But, you know, there's some farmers from Canada that have moved down here into the United States because they wanted to have that freedom to expand and stuff and that. Not saying they can't expand in Canada, but again, like I said before, they have to buy the quota. The quota, and we just, 2 weeks ago, we had some Canadian farm organizations that had met with Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation Board of Directors. We asked them what a quota would cost. A quota on a cow is $35,000. So if you want to add two cows, it's going to cost you $70,000 just to buy the quota to ship the milk, let alone now you still got to purchase the cows or if you have the heifers come in and all the other stuff that goes with it. So they get a good price for their milk. They know what they're going to get for their milk, whereas here in the States, as Mike was talking about with the timber industry, we don't know what we're getting paid for our milk. That milk is gone. The plant has it, and we know basically a month after it's shipped what we're going to get for it.
Matt, as I understand it, in the U.S., most logging is done by private companies on privately held land. Canadian timber producers harvest their timber on government land with the companies paying a fee to harvest. And some U.S. companies have charged that this constitutes an unfair government subsidy, allowing Canada once again to flood the market with its cheap softwood. Is there anything to that?
Well, yes. I mean, to my knowledge, you know, I mean, the government owns the land, so they're allocated a certain quota or a certain amount of timber that they produce, and then the government, the Canadian government, actually markets the forest products. Where in the United States, you know, you're free to you bid and on a federal, state, county, private timber sales. So technically, the logging community there doesn't pay a stumpage rate. So it would be like me competing with the Canadian government for a market. So that's where the, you know, and they can absorb and change with markets much faster than I can as an individual. You know, there's no way you could compete with a Canadian government versus an individual.
And Canadian officials are pushing back on this. They say the White House assertions that its lumber industry is unfairly subsidized is wrong. Their Minister of Foreign Affairs, Chrystia Freeland is her name, noted that lumber prices are rising, and she said if the market was being flooded by cheap Canadian lumber, you wouldn't see the price going up.
Well, basically, as far as the pricing goes, I mean, what I'm seeing the biggest deficiency is with those products coming into the U.S., it is flooding the market and therefore driving down the price, and then there's no demand or less demand. That's the major thing that I see. The price will dictate by the way the economy is going in both countries, for that matter.
Let's move on to NAFTA. President Trump said only a month ago that he wanted to scrap the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now he says he wants to renegotiate it. Is that a good idea for dairy farmers, Don Ratke?
NAFTA was a good thing for dairy, and because most of ours is raw product, what's moving, we make more money if it's a finished product, just like any other manufacturing. But because a lot of ours is just a raw product that's going, not just dairy, but all the other ag commodities or whatever that are traded or between Canada or whatever. So NAFTA was a good thing. We were concerned as an organization when he made those comments. We have had conversations with the administration, meaning we, the AFBF, American Farm Bureau Federation. So we're glad that he's kind of changed it. We're not against renegotiating it, but to scrap it completely would have been, I think, for farmers would have been a bad deal.
Matt, is renegotiating NAFTA a good idea for timber producers?
Well, I think any negotiation is better. I think the president was smart by he's the art of the deal. He says we're going to scrap this thing. Guess what? The next day or very quickly after that, the president of Mexico the president, the prime minister, whichever of both countries called him up and said, "Geez, we'd like to talk about this." Well, that's exactly what he wanted to happen. So I think that was a smart play on his part. And so, yes, I think it's a good thing to negotiate it and hopefully be a positive for American businesses, which we haven't seen the pro-business aspect in our government for a while, so it's kind of refreshing. I'm optimistic that something good or better will come out of it based on compared to what it is now, for sure.
You know, you're right. Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto both did call up Donald Trump, and you know, maybe his tough talk was working.
I think so. And, you know, there's been this controversy, you know, not to get too political on things, but when the president said, you know, Mexico's going to pay for the wall, well, this free trade agreement in a roundabout way is going to, by generating business and dollars for American business, is going to pay for that wall, if you will. So it's refreshing to see that President Trump is going pro-business and America first. When we in America are dependent upon by many countries, whether it's military or aid financially or just aid in general, America's got to be healthy, and our businesses and our people have to be healthy and strong and competitive so that we can help other countries, which we are relied on. And it's a good thing, but I'm very happy to see some pro-business, pro-America things, and we'll see where this shakes out, but I'm optimistic.
Don Ratke, are there pitfalls when so many of our businesses rely on free trade?
No, I think we need to go back and renegotiate. Like we were talking about with the ultra-filtered milk, that was it's a product that we have now that when it was negotiated way back then, we didn't have. So maybe there should be some provision in there that says every so many years or whatever, we do go back and renegotiate or look at it because things have changed. And hopefully we can maybe alleviate some of these issues that we've had here with what we've gone through lately.
Let's go back to the phones. Leslie in Rhinelander, you're on with Matt Jensen and Don Ratke. Hello, Leslie.
Hi, guys. Hi, good morning, guys. This is really interesting, and I find it's great that you actually have both agriculture and forestry represented and talking the way you are today. A couple things I want to know if you're aware of, and I'm very interested about. I work with small farmholders, agriculture, and I also am in research with the University of Missouri, which has one of the largest agroforestry departments and natural resources departments in the United States, and is highly respected. And some of the issues I keep coming up and I keep seeing is, and you're bringing it up, is the issues of subsidies, which go, when you're talking about Canadian subsidizing, and then the subsidizing that goes on here in the U.S., which you guys are talking about, are the big businesses, the big agribusinesses, which are not giving the fair share to both small and medium-sized farmers, ranchers, and the timber industry, which I didn't know was not subsidized. There is a big push right now in coming up with the Farm Bill for equal ground for small farmers, ranchers, and people that are private land owners who have forests, for diversification and just a fair shake for everybody all the way around, including a diversification which would also allow agroforestry, where before it's always been sort of looked at as really two separate industries, agriculture and forestry. But in fact, there is a lot of crossover into both of these industries, if you want.
Okay.
That has a history to it. And also carbon farming. So I want to find out if you guys know about carbon farming, which is actually starting to take place with a lot of money that's available to you out of New York is starting, and I have access if you want to talk about this. I got your names, and also about agroforestry as a diversification.
All right, Leslie, you've got a lot that you just put on our table here.
It's a great program.
Let's see if we can. Thank you so much. Let's see if we can have our guests chip away at it. Matt Jensen, let's talk about subsidies. Is there a difference between the way the timber industry and the dairy industry are subsidized?
Well, yes. The logging industry isn't subsidized in any way, shape, or form. So I don't know all of the subsidies, if there are or aren't, in agriculture. But the forest products industry is not subsidized in any way. There's no type of crop insurance or timber sale insurance, if you want to use that word. There is no quota guarantees, no insurance. So we're weather dependent. So if we don't get product to a mill or a various facility that takes our raw material, we don't get paid. There isn't any subsidy of any kind. There's no low interest loans. There's no we can't even at this point have a 16-year-old our own children work legally in our own family business. That's one of the things we're working on nationally, is getting that change so that we can have our family members, our own children, work in some of our mechanized equipment, which is today is as safe as being in your vehicle.
All right, thanks.
So no subsidies.
Okay, let's deal with subsidies here, Don. Is there a difference between the dairy industry and the timber industry?
Yeah, there are subsidies on the corn, grain, or commodities that way. The crop insurance is subsidized somewhat by the government, but that's a choice that the farmer himself makes if they want to participate in it or not. On the dairy side, when the farm bill was written last time, dairy prices were good. So we did give up some protection, or however you would want to say it. So we'd like to renegotiate the farm bill now to make it it's supposed to help out in low prices. And where we're at now, even with the low prices, a lot of farmers aren't getting a lot of the help that they feel they should be getting. So,
Leslie, thanks so much for the phone call. We're running short on time, so I'm going to take another break here. We are discussing Wisconsin's timber and dairy industries and the trade dispute with Canada with Matt Jensen of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and Don Ratke of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. We're going to take a short pledge break. Here's the Canadian children's song stylist, Michael Mitchell.
I've got Canada in my pocket, a little bit of history. A penny and a nickel and a quarter and a dime mean a lot to you and me. It's more than pocket money. They're the symbols of our land. They're pictures of important things for which this country stands.
Support for WPR comes from Captain's Walk Winery, located in a historic Italianate home in downtown Green Bay, featuring wine and cider tasting and a menu of tapas and pizzas. More at captainswalkwinery.com. Support also comes from attorneys Sturgill and Long, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and the Michigan Upper Peninsula. Information is at 888-613-0600.
The Guess Who's singing about a small town in Saskatchewan, taking us into our final segment of Route 51 as we talk about the trade dispute with Canada and its impact on Wisconsin's timber and dairy industries with Matt Jensen of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and Don Ratke of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. I'm Glenn Moberg, and please help support Route 51 and Wisconsin Public Radio during this, our spring pledge drive. I want to talk with both of you a bit about other challenges facing your industries, which have often butted heads with environmentalists, most recently, Don, over the bill that just passed the state Senate, further easing restrictions on high-capacity wells used by ag interests and dairy farmers. They're blamed in the Golden Sands region for lakes, trout streams, and private wells drying up. Is this legislature doing too much to help the ag industry here, and are they risking a backlash from citizens?
It's one of those things where you've got industry, the dairy or the vegetable and potato growers, that they're dependent on the water to grow the food. So it gets to be who's going to get the water first, and how much you want to end up paying for your food. There's probably, hopefully it doesn't end up being a backlash. We have to try to find that balance of, what we can do and how we can do it. And what works good for the whole community. It shouldn't be just all one-sided, and I hope it doesn't end up being that way.
Matt, a lot of environmentalists don't want to see trees cut down. How do you respond to them and convince them that maybe they should take another look at what you do?
Well, yes, that's an ongoing battle. It's all about education. I try and get folks out, and whether it's landowners, and educate them on a proper forestry. But the best way, you know, we talk about climate change is such a big topic today. The best way to sequester carbon is a healthy forest by harvesting trees. There's an aspen clear cut, a young forest, sequesters more carbon than any other form that I know of. So in the western United States is literally burning up every fall or every year in fire season, and that is based on lack of timber management. If we have healthy forests, we can not have to worry about the forest burning up and getting rid of that fuel load. A healthy forest will grow faster. It will sustain more drought and disease. And so those are the things that we have to educate folks on. And it's a very emotional thing. We've been dealing with this for a long, long time. My answer to those folks is get in touch with us. We'll definitely show you that. I've lived in the forest here, being a third generation logger. I raise a family, making a living in the forest. The last thing that I want to do is cut every tree down. My children grow up around me. They look and see what I do. The last thing I want to do is cut down the forest.
And Don, I'd like you to comment briefly on organic farms and groups like Farmshed and Stevens Point that are stressing doing things on a small scale instead of mega dairies with thousands of milking cows. Is there room for both of these trends, big mega farms and also small sustainable agriculture in Wisconsin? And unfortunately, you've got about 40 seconds here to give me the answer.
They can exist together because you have the group that wants to know where their food comes from. That's kind of where the big push has been coming with the organic. More people want to know how their food is produced. But you have the other segment of society that's, I want the cheapest food I can get. I want to be able to walk in a grocery store and buy it when I want it, how I want it. They don't care where it comes from as long as the things are in place for the regulations that the food is safe and processed safe. So they can coexist, but it's a niche market. And if you're willing to pay for it because they pay extra for their organic because of the processes of what they end up doing, and as long as they're willing to pay for it, those people will exist just as long as the big mega farms do.
And Matt Jensen, just very briefly, you've got about 15 seconds here. I know what your answer is. You think we're doing a pretty good job right now in Wisconsin with our timber policy?
I absolutely do. We've got some of the best forestry schools in the state. We've got some of the best pro-forestry measures put in place and proper sustainable timber harvesting. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you both for being with us today.
There is a town in North Ontario.
We want to thank today's guests, Matt Jensen, Vice President of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association and owner of Whitetail Logging of Crandon, and Don Ratke, Vice President of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation and the Farm Operations Manager for North Central Technical College's Agriculture Center of Excellence. You can find out more about the Great Lakes Timber Professionals at gltpa.org. And you can find out more about the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation at WFBF.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our show producer and on-air producer, Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by the Sam Roberts Band, Wilf Carter, Gordon Lightfoot, Ian and Sylvia, Michael Mitchell, The Guess Who, and Neil Young. They're all Canadians. If you missed part of the program, we'll rebroadcast it in its entirety Friday evening at 7 on 90.9 FM Wausau. Please help support us during our Spring Pledge Drive. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we're heading out of town.